Good morning. If you open your Bible to any one of the Gospels, they will end with the death of Christ and his resurrection, but they start at different places. Mark starts with Jesus as an adult. John goes back to Jesus in pre-existence, and then by verse 14, you have the incarnation and you have his life as an adult. Matthew, you start with the genealogy and birth of Christ. Luke, you back up actually to the prediction and birth of John the Baptist and of Christ. And then you get one glimpse of Jesus at age 12. And then at age 30, he begins his ministry. So you put them together and you have the birth in Bethlehem in Luke and in Matthew, the escape to Egypt in Matthew 2, and then back up to Nazareth, and then the event in Luke chapter 2 at age 12, and the mention that he advanced in wisdom, stature, and favor, and then he begins his ministry at age 30. In the early centuries, there were some people who tried to fill in that gap and write some ridiculous things about what Jesus was like as a little boy. If you've ever read the Gospel of Thomas, the infancy gospel of Thomas, you know what that's about. And it's a lot of nonsense. A friend of mine wrote a book recently, and he asked me to read it, and he wants me to get back to him on it. And it has a picture on the front of Jesus sitting in kind of a Buddhist meditation pose. And he believes he knows where Jesus was in this second gap right there. His whole book isn't about that, but it's somewhat central to the book. And he didn't originate the idea. It comes from a Russian writer in the late 1800s who wrote a book and claimed to have found a manuscript that you will never see that claims that Jesus spent that time in India. And so we're going to be looking at that idea this morning. It was a new idea to me, but turns out there's a lot of people saying this. The unknown life of Jesus Christ, the tale of Isa, which is an Arabic way of saying Jesus, Arabic pronunciation, King of Travelers, Jesus Lost Years in India, The Life of Saint Isa, The Missing Years of Jesus and His Travels in the East, The Jesus Mystery, BBC documentary, The Lost Years of Jesus, a movie, Jesus in India, The Lost Years of Jesus, and more books, often with similar looking themes and such. I did not realize there were so many people out there saying this. It's kind of tied into the New Age appetite, where you kind of want a little bit of this and that. And so if you can kind of blend Buddhism and Christianity together, it's popular among certain circles. But the question is, well, what about the claim and evaluating it? Almost all of these go back to and have been influenced by Nicholas Notovitch, who in the 1880s said he discovered a manuscript in a monastery, a Buddhist monastery, that told of the life of Jesus in India. The Unknown Life of Jesus Christ, original text of Nicholas Notovitch's 1887 discovery by Nicholas Notovitch, printed in the United States of America. You can find it online and read it if you like. I'll show you a few excerpts this morning. But he's going to claim that Jesus went to India at age 13, and he spent about 6 years with Hindus over here, and then up in Nepal, spent about 6 years with the Buddhists, and then came back and went through Persia and did some things there and got back to the Holy Land when he was 29. Now, the way he describes this, he describes his travels. He was a Russian, and he's traveling through India, he says, and he stops at this monastery, Malbec Monastery, up in Kashmir. This side is Tibet, and that side is Afghanistan, and there's a little bit of India sticking up there. And he stops here at the Malbec Monastery, And he's talking to the llama there, not a South American llama, which is the animal, but the Buddhist llama, like Dalai Lama. He's talking to the llama, and the llama supposedly says this: "The only fault of Christians is that after having adopted the great doctrines of Buddha, they have completely separated themselves from him and have created for themselves a different Dalai Lama." Norvitz supposedly says, "Which Dalai Lama of the Christians do you refer to?" I ask him, "We have one, the Son of God." The Lama says, "It is not him of whom it is a question, Sahib. We too respect him, whom we reverence as the Son of the one and indivisible God. But we do not see in him the only Son, but the excellent being who is chosen among all. Buddha, indeed, has incarnated himself with his divine nature in the person of the sacred Issa, who has gone forth to propagate our true and great religion among all the world. Him whom I meant was your..." When we talked about the mistake of following your own Dalai Lama. "Him whom I meant was your terrestrial Dalai Lama, he to whom you have given the title Father of the Church. That is a great sin." Norvitz supposedly says, "I understood now that he alluded to the Pope." And then he says to the Lama, "You have told me that a son of Buddha, Issa, the elect among all, had spread your religion on the earth. Who is he?" I asked. At this question, the Lama's eyes opened wide. He looked at me with astonishment. "Issa," he finally replied, "is a great prophet. One of the first after the 22 Buddhas. He is greater than any one of all the Dalai Lamas." And it says, "His name and his acts," down in the yellow, "have been chronicled in our sacred writings. And when reading how his great life passed away in the midst of an erring people, we weep for the horrible sin of the heathen who murdered him after subjecting him to torture." Now, as we go through this, you're going to see plenty of evidence to know how to evaluate this, but we'll continue to go through and let you see what the claim is. "I was struck by this recital of the Lama. The prophet Issa, his tortures, his death, our Christian Dalai Lama, the Buddhist recognizing Christianity, all these made me think more and more of Jesus Christ. I asked my interpreter not to lose a single word of what the Lama told me." Now, keep in mind this and another person later who will say they've seen this manuscript, they're having to work through an interpreter. Keep that in mind. "Where can those writings be found, and who compiled them?" I asked the monk. And the monk says, "The principal scrolls, which were written in India and Nepal at different epochs," and the spelling in this is different than your spelling, but it was written in Russian, translated and printed as is, so I'm just using his spelling. "At different epochs, as the events have happened, are in Lhasa several thousands in number." Lhasa is way over here. There's a huge monastery over there, and it's like 800 to 900 miles away. And he said, "The principal scrolls are in Lhasa, several thousand in number. In some convents, great convents, are to be found copies which the lamas during their sojourn in Lhasa have made at various times and have given them to their cloisters as souvenirs of the period they spent with the Dalai Lama." So later, another lama is going to say there's like 84,000 scrolls, and different people are mentioned in different ones of them, and that type of stuff. But a lot of them are over there, and they say a lot of people have never seen them. But if you go there, you get to take some scrolls back or copies back and give them to your cloister, etc. And so Norbit supposedly says, "But you yourselves, do you not possess copies of the scrolls bearing upon the prophet Issa?" "We have not. Our convent is insignificant. Since its foundation, our successful lamas have only had a few hundred manuscripts in their library. The great cloisters have several thousands of them, but they are sacred things which will not anywhere be shown to you." And so he says they spoke a bit more, and he thought, "I'm going to stick around and see if I can try to find some convent somewhere, some monastery, where I can see some of these manuscripts." Well, He's not going to go to Lhasa, but he travels a little ways, I think it was 100 and something miles, and he gets to Hemis Monastery. And he's having a conversation there with the Lama. And he said, in a visit which I recently made to a Gompa, a monastery, he's talking about the first one. I think this is all fabricated language, but this is the claim of the book. One of the Lamas told me of a prophet, or as you call him, a Buddha, by the name of Issa. Could you not tell me anything about him? The Lama says, the name Issa is very much respected among the Buddhists, he replied. But he is only known by the chief Lamas who have read the scrolls relating to his life. Every disciple or Lama who visits Lhasa makes a gift of one or several copies from the scrolls there to the convent which he belongs. Our Gompa, among others, possesses already a great number. Among them are memoirs of the life and acts of the Buddha Issa, who preached the same doctrine in India and among the sons of Israel, and who was put to death by the pagans, and whose descendants later on adopted the beliefs he spread, and those beliefs are yours. It is about 2,000 years ago, et cetera, et cetera. He says this sacred child attained a certain age. He was brought to India. Until he attained manhood, he studied the laws of the great Buddha. So this sets up the claims that Notovitch is going to make in this book. Notovitch supposedly says, would you commit a sin in reciting a copy of the life of Issa to a stranger? The Lama says, that which belongs to God, he answered me, belongs to man, also to man. Our duty requires us to cheerfully devote ourselves to the propagation of his doctrine. Only I do not at present know where that manuscript is. If you ever visit our Gompa again, I shall take pleasure in showing it to you. Well, he leaves and hopes to someday see it, and he falls off his horse, breaks his leg, needs to go somewhere, so he goes back to the monastery. They doctor him up, so he says. And during his stay there, at length, yielding to my ardent insistence, he brought me two big books, the large leaves of which were paper yellow with age, and from them read to me the biography of Issa, which I carefully transcribed in my traveling notebook according to the translation made by my interpreter. This curious document is compiled under a form of isolated verses, which has placed very often had no apparent connection with or relation to each other. And he says, I kind of sorted them and put them back together in his publication. All right. This is Nicholas Notovitch. And he says, the two manuscripts from which the Lama of the convent Hemis read to me, that all had a bearing on Jesus, are compilations from diverse copies written in the Tibetan language, translations of scrolls belonging to the Library of Lhasa. The details concerning Jesus given in the Chronicles are disconnected, mingled with other accounts, contemporaneous events to which they bear no relation. The manuscripts relate to us, first of all, according to the accounts given by merchants arriving from Judea in the same year when the death of Jesus occurred. So this is his claim. And of course, there was trade in the ancient world. And so he's going to say that merchants came from Jerusalem in this same year when Jesus died. They got to India and they started telling about what had happened in Jerusalem. And then this reminded some of them, oh yeah, he used to be here, and so on. About this Issa, an Israelite, in spite of being acquitted twice by the judges, being a man of God, was nevertheless put to death by the order of the pagan governor Pilate. So his claim, Jesus leaves Nazareth at age 13, does not return till age 29, and he spends time here and here, along with Persia, etc. In leaving, he says, the royal lineage of Jesus, his rare intelligence and his learning, and he seems to think that there is almost no sons of David left in Judah, and so everybody's looking to him, which would not have been the case, but caused him to be looked on as an excellent match for a son-in-law. And so he believes that people are wanting one of their daughters to marry him, and being betrothed at a young age or whatever. And Jesus doesn't want to do that. He, being a meditative youth, didn't want to do that. And he was possessed with thirst for knowledge. So he left home and he joined caravans going to India. Now look what he says here. Here the evangelist once more lose the thread of the terrestrial life of Jesus. Luke says he was in the deserts till the day of his showing unto Israel, which clearly demonstrates that nobody knew where the holy youth was until his sudden reappearance 16 years later. Now, the first thing we're going to check is open up to Luke 1:80. Does the text say that the child grew, waxed strong in spirit, was in the deserts until the day of his showing in Israel? I'm seeing some heads nod yes. Everybody look there. Do you see that in Luke 1:80? Who's Luke 1:80 about? John the Baptist. So right away we're beginning to get a little bit of a picture of how reliable this fella is scholarship-wise. But we will continue. After this was published, there was a journal called the 19th Century. It was a British monthly founded by Sir James Knowles, and there were different academic articles in there. And a fellow responded to this book, and he was well positioned to do so. He was a very respected scholar, Max Müller, who he was the editor of the 51-volume series of translations, The Sacred Books of the East. So this is the scholar, the editor, and he's very interested in India, and he had edited the 51-volume set on the sacred texts of the East. Well, then he sees, you know, the nonsense in this book. He points out the flaws in it and dismantles it pretty good. He says, I'm not going to say he's a liar. Maybe the monks took advantage of him or whatever. And then there's other people write in and they say, you know, we talked to the monastery, and because in his book he said when he went back, he gave like an alarm clock and a thermometer as a gift to the guy. And the guy said, no, this didn't happen. This is all lies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so it kind of died down. In his second edition, he may have even kind of backtracked some of his claims about the manuscripts, but it somewhat died down. Then, in 1922, Swami Abhedananda, I'm not going to try to say it, went to the Hemis Monastery, and he said he saw the manuscripts. So now we have, in the 1880s, a Russian that said he saw the manuscripts, and now we have, and there's maybe another supposed sighting or two, but this would be the one that would be most notable. This Swami said that he saw it, and so he wrote this book, Journey into Kashmir and Tibet. And in 1926, the story resurfaces. And then you get to like by the 60s and stuff, and you hit the New Age movement, and it's kind of a popular theme. And so you got all these books bouncing around in documentaries and movies and stuff. Fringe, but it's a popular idea within a lot of people, and sooner or later you may be running into this. So we're going to do some comparisons. First off, comparison A, the Book of Mormon and the life of Saint Isa. Joseph Smith alleged to have found an important ancient text, right? And it was published in imitation of 1611 King James. So like in the 1800s, people did not speak the way they did in 1611. But if you look at Joseph Smith's, you know, Book of Mormon, you know, thou therefore, you know, it's written in 1611 style. And it claims that Jesus went to the West. If you've ever read the Book of Mormon, it says that Jesus, after a number of other events, came to the New World and appointed apostles here, etc. And Smith and Martin Harris claim that a scholar spoke favorably about the Reformed Egyptian characters that were taken to him and translation shown to him. But there was no confirmation from that scholar. He replied back and he said, no, he knew it was a fraud. And although witnesses said it exists, every single Book of Mormon has in the front the three witnesses. And then the eight witnesses of the golden plates, right? Do you get to see the golden plates? Can you go to Utah and say, hey, I'd really like to see those golden? No, the angel took those back up. And so you just have those witnesses. Now look at Nicholas Notovitch's book. He alleges to have found an important ancient text. And as you're going to see when I show you some excerpts, guess how it's worded? In 1611 King James type language. And this one claims that Jesus went to the east. And it's alleged that a scholar spoke favorably about it, but there's no confirmation from the scholar because he said he waited until the guy was dead. And later, another fellow is going to say he finds it, but the text is still not available for us to examine. So, what about this idea of the witness? It's helpful to look at witnesses. For instance, Martin Harris is one of the three witnesses to the Book of Mormon. And so if you open a Book of Mormon, I've got some back there, I can show it to you, and it says, you know, we saw it, et cetera, et cetera. In one of them, it's we hefted it, et cetera. And one of them is Martin Harris. I've also got a reproduction of the 1830 edition of the Book of Mormon, published by a Mormon. And he also published the printer's statement with it. And there's something in there really interesting that the printer says. The printer says, Martin was in the office when I finished setting up the type of the testimony of the three. I said to him, Martin, did you see those plates with your naked eyes? Martin looked down for an instant, raised his eyes up and said, no, I saw them with a spiritual eye. Well, that's kind of an altogether different thing. If you're going to say to people, yeah, I saw the plates. In my imagination, basically, is what you have here. Well, what about this Swami? This is a Buddhist, a current Buddhist, and on his blog, he talks about this, and there's even people now saying that Jesus went and studied at that Hemis monastery. And he points out that obviously couldn't happen because it was only built in the 1600s. But he said, in 1989, now this is a Buddhist, in 1989, I stayed at Hemis, which is a Buddhist monastery, as a guest of a senior monk there, had the good fortune to witness the famous Hemis festival. I asked my host about the Jesus story. He groaned, rolled his eyes upwards, and told me that Westerners often come to the monastery and ask about Jesus, and that some of the younger monks string them along for both fun and profit, mainly for profit. So if that's happening now, what might have been happening in 1922 when the Swami went there? Because he went there, and they showed him a writing that he couldn't read, and he had to have somebody translate him and tell him what it was, and it matched what Nicholas Notovitch said and published a number of years before. So guess what they could have done? They could have read to him or memorized some of the stuff out of Notovitch's thing and gave that to him and said, oh, that's what that said. And whether they were doing it for fun or profit. And that's assuming that the Swami was telling the truth, but he could have easily been deceived. I'm not going to take time to go through this. There was a scholar supposedly with the Mormon. Here's Renan. I'll just mention he went to Renan, who was a renowned expert, and I think I'm pronouncing his name wrong, but he was interested in presenting it to the Academy. But Notovitch says, I realized he would get all the credit. And Notovitch wanted the credit, so I waited until he was dead, you know, to not offend him. And judging by his health, when I visited him, it didn't look like it would be too long. Waited until he was dead and then went. But now that gives you the ability to name drop him in a favorable way without him being able to say anything about it, doesn't it? Here's another comparison. I suspect that Notovitch is trying to duplicate the fame of Tischendorf. Tischendorf discovered the Codex Sinaiticus. He's famous for discovering an important ancient text. He was serving as an envoy for Russia, although he himself was German. He discovered it in a remote monastery in Arabia. What does Notovitch do? A few years later, he's seeking fame for discovering an important ancient text. He is a Russian, would have known about Tischendorf certainly, and he picks the discovery place to be a remote monastery in India. In fact, in his book, he talks about how remote some of that area is. Now, what's the difference between these two? I'll tell you what the difference is. Constantine Tischendorf really found a manuscript. It's from about 325 to 350. It's a handwritten copy of the Bible, and it's the most of our early copies will be like, say, the letters of Paul, or maybe just this epistle or that, or the Gospels, or one, this Gospel, or the Luke Acts, or something like that. It's not all of them all together in the same manuscript. This is the earliest manuscript that has all of the New Testament books together in the same thing. So he's famous for discovering it. He found it in a remote monastery, in an ancient monastery near Mount Sinai. He was acting as an envoy for Russia. He got the manuscript for the Tsar, Alexander II. 1933, after the Russians aren't interested in something biblical, they sell it to the British for about $500,000, and you can go to the British Museum and see it. And I suspect some of you may have been in the British Museum and may have seen it. And if you don't have the money to fly to the British Museum, you can just look online. It's right there. You can scroll through. Well, not scroll because it's a codex book type, but you can flip through. You know, you can look at the different pages. You can zoom in. There's the golden rule right there. Matthew chapter 7, verse 12. You can see it. He discovered an important ancient manuscript, and you can see it. It's in the museum. It's online. That's the way it is even with some nonsense manuscripts like the Nag Hammadi Library. It's a bunch of Gnostic nonsense, but the books are real. They really were written in, say, in the 400s or something, and they've got some crazy stuff in them, but they're in museums. You can look at them. The Dead Sea Scrolls, both the biblical ones and the community ones and such, they're in museums. You can look at them. This Gospel of Issa, this story of Issa, you can't see it. Nobody's seen it. I think the last sighting might have been that one supposedly in 1922. Now, let me give you a few excerpts from it. It's not very long, and I'll give you a few excerpts so you can judge it for yourself. The Life of Saint Issa, Best of the Sons of Men. Chapter 1. The earth trembled and the heavens wept because of the great crime committed in the land of Israel. For there was tortured and murdered the great and just Issa, in whom was manifest the soul of the universe, which had incarnated in a simple mortal to benefit men and destroy the evil spirit in them, to lead back to peace, love, and happiness man degraded by his sins, and recall him to the one and indivisible Creator whose mercy is infinite. The merchants coming from Israel have given the following account of what has occurred. Chapter 2. The people of Israel, who inhabit a fertile country producing two harvests a year and affording pasture for large herds of cattle, by their sins brought down upon themselves the anger of the Lord, who inflicted upon them terrible chastisements, taking from them their land, their cattle, their wealth. They were carried away into slavery by the rich and mighty pharaohs who ruled the land of Egypt. And then it goes down, it has them down in the land of Egypt, and then Moses delivers him, who is not an Israelite, and etc. And then they go back to the land of Israel. Now, of course, right away, you notice a difference there. They went down to Egypt voluntarily, well, except for Joseph. He was sold into slavery, but then he rose to power. Chapter 3. Many centuries had elapsed since their exodus from Egypt when God bethought himself of again inflicting chastisement upon them, Strangers invaded Israel, devastated the land, destroyed the villages, carried their inhabitants away into captivity. At last came the pagans from over the sea, from the land of the Romels. Now he's got a footnote there, and you go to the back of the book, and he says it's the Romans. Okay? So you think, is that Rome? Yeah, it's Rome. These made themselves masters of the Hebrews, placed over them their army chiefs who governed in the name of Caesar. Think about your history. Think about your Old Testament history with Babel and such. Think about your New Testament history, your intertestamental period, and your New Testament history as we read this next part. The Romans, they defiled the temples, forced the inhabitants to cease the worship of the indivisible God, compelled them to sacrifice to heathen gods. The Israelites came in multitudes to listen to Esau's words, and they asked him where they should thank their heavenly father since their enemies had demolished their temples and robbed them of their sacred vessels. The Babylonians took some sacred vessels. Antiochus Epiphanes, you know, back before the Maccabean revolt was causing trouble and stuff. But did the Romans do this? The Romans will destroy the temple when? 40 years after the death of Christ. Not before the death of Christ. What is this talking about? Now, when you get to the end, he's going to say, you'll have noticed some difference, some contradictions between the records of the Bible and the Hindu records. And he's going to say you should trust the Hindu records more. They had an alphabet earlier, and they didn't get into this type of thing. Any merchant from Jerusalem that went to India in the first century AD, around 30 AD, would know the temple was standing. And in fact, as you go through here, then it talks about Jesus going to the temple. So it doesn't even make sense. What is it talking about here, that the Romans had destroyed their temple in the time of Christ, and so they don't know where to go to pray? The temple is standing. It's still going to be being worked on until in the 60s, in fact. It was a magnificent structure. It was an amazing place. It's where the Jews went. And besides that, they had synagogues all over the place where Jesus grew up. So if he meant synagogues, because it said temples, synagogues aren't temples, but just to cover that base as well, in Nazareth, Jesus goes to the synagogue. When he moves to Capernaum, he goes to the synagogue. And do you remember who built the synagogue in Capernaum? A Roman centurion. You remember they said he built the synagogue for us. And so you don't have a Roman hostility not letting Jews worship. When they go down to Jerusalem in the feast, there's synagogue there. Jesus went about, Matthew 4, teaching in their synagogues. About all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues. When Paul's on the missionary journeys, you got synagogues all over the place. So if you got the temple, you got synagogues all over the place. What's this about that the Romans won't let them worship? Now watch this. Chapter 10. The priests and elders who heard him were filled with admiration for his language. In this, Notovitch makes Pilate the bad guy, and the chief priests are begging Pilate to free Jesus and let him go to the feast. Pilate's the bad guy. Nicholas Notovitch is a Jew. He's a Russian, but he's Jewish. And while ever he's doing whatever motives he has to become famous and get money or whatever else, he's rewritten history. So, when the priests and elders heard Esau, they decided among themselves not to give judgments against him, for he'd done no harm to anyone. Presenting themselves to Pilate, who was made governor of Jerusalem by the pagan king of the Romans, they said, "We have seen the man whom you charge with inciting our people to revolt. We have heard his discourse. We know he's our countryman. Chiefs of the cities have given you false reports. He's a just man who teaches the people the word of God. After interrogating, we allowed him to go in peace." That's the chief. So this is supposed to be the more accurate version, according to this guy. Also, look at the last one there. And then Pilate gets very angry. Jesus says to people, don't put your faith in miracles. It's not a long text. It's like it's a thing, and but Notovitch has a bunch of other things he writes before and after it. But you know what's missing? He's not healing people. He's not raising the dead. He's not making the blind to see. You don't see him working miracles. Here he tells the people, put not your faith in miracles performed by the hands of man. He who rules nature alone is capable of doing things like what? Arresting the wrath of the winds or causing the rain to fall. Well, that was something the Bible says Jesus clearly was able to do. But Issa's growing popularity did not sit well with Pilate. And you see the principal priests and wise elders, they're begging Pilate to liberate him. We cannot condemn him, say the priests and the ancients. Pilate became enraged and ordered him to be condemned to death. And the judges, this is the priests and the elders, say, we cannot consent this great sin to condemn an innocent man. And the priests and elders walked out and washed their hands and said, we're innocent of the blood of this innocent man. So clearly we have not just revisionism here, but a lot of nonsense. This is what Notovitch says. I leave it to the savants, I guess he means wise there, the philosophers and the theologians to search into the cause for the contradictions which may be found between the life of Issa, which I lay before the public, and the accounts of the Gospels. I trust everybody will agree with me in assuming that the version which I present to the public, one compiled 3 or 4 years after the death of Jesus, and from accounts of eyewitnesses and contemporaries, has much more probability of being in conformity with the truth than the accounts of the Gospels. And he says the evangelists compiled their writings long after, and he said this was soon after the passion occurred, and it gives us a very complete detailed description of the life of Jesus. Well, no, it gives a lot of nonsense, and it's not that detailed either. But as we start to wind up here, let's just look at the historical record. For us as believers, well, the four Gospels, what's the role of the chief priests and the elders? Well, Luke chapter 9, Jesus had said, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed. Mark 14, Judas came, one of the 12, with him, a crowd with swords and clubs. And who are they from? From the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. Matthew 27, all the chief priests and the elders took counsel to put Jesus to death. Mark 15, the chief priests held a consultation with the elders, and they bound Jesus and delivered him to Pilate. Pilate's the one that didn't want to kill Jesus, as you remember from the text. But it's Matthew 27, the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. And it's Pilate that says, are you a king? And he says, your own nation and the chief priests have delivered over to me. What have you done? Pilate went back outside of the Jews and said, I find no guilt in him. The chief priests and the officers cried out, crucify him, crucify him. But if you have a friend and or you go to school somewhere, or you start running into people that said, oh, like you remember the Da Vinci Code book and all that stuff about the Gospel of Philip, and that was more nonsense, and said, oh, but here, this. And the thing is, they're not going to accept you showing them this, because what's presented in the life of Issa is like, this is accurate, because it was like right afterwards. And it was eyewitnesses were right there and they wrote it right away. You know, it was, they got there just the same year. And it's all written down. So they're going to say, well, why should I trust that? So the next points, or I'll skip a couple here and get to the points that you can help somebody with on that. The book of Acts, let's just mention, you see persecution continuing there. Saul of Tarsus, of course, he's getting letters from the chief priests, et cetera, et cetera. But they would say, well, that's your New Testament. How about this? This is Mara bar Serapion. He is a Stoic philosopher writing sometime after 73 AD. We don't know when. And he's listing people who have rejected or killed other people to no avail and to fault. And he recognized the execution as a Jewish initiative, not a Roman one. This is what he said. What advantage did the Jews gain from executing their wise king? So there's an external testimony about who was responsible for that. And how about what the Jews themselves said? What did the rabbis say? The Talmud was written between like 200 to 500 AD. And it's the descendants of the Pharisees is what it is. The rabbis were the Pharisees that survived and went on after the destruction of the temple. And they claimed Jesus was guilty, worthy to die, and indefensible. So this is from the Talmud, Sanhedrin 43. On the eve of the Passover, Yeshua, Jesus. Remember that Jesus' name was Joshua, or as they would pronounce it, Yeshua. On the eve of the Passover, Yeshua was hanged. Before the execution took place, a herald went forth and cried, "He has practiced sorcery and enticed Israel to apostasy. Anyone who can say anything in his favor, let him come forward and plead on his behalf." But since nothing was brought forward in his favor, he was hanged on the eve of Passover. Uler retorted, "Do you suppose that he was one from whom a defense could be made?" Okay, so who's that from? That's from the Jewish rabbis. So you've got a claim from somebody, and now a bunch of people selling books claiming that this Russian fellow claiming to have seen a manuscript that you will never see and it's never going to be in a museum anywhere. And it's a fraud. It's simply, that's not, a merchant from Jerusalem would not have gone back saying, "Oh, the chief priests, they loved him." He would not have gone back and said, "Hey, the Romans had destroyed the temple," etc. And winding up with this. He's not a miracle worker, and it ends without a resurrection. It ends with saying there were some guards, and the tomb was empty, and a rumor went out that maybe God took the body away. But there's no resurrection. And then when you read Norvitz's comments about it, he tells you what he thinks happened. He thinks all Israel is coming because everybody, the chief priests, the scribes, everybody is so disappointed that Jesus is dead. Everybody's there at the tomb, and the guard, they're giving the guards a rough time. And so they say, "We got to get the body out of here so that they won't make this a shrine." And so he claims that Pilate ordered the body to be taken away. So let's just end with this. Romans chapter 1 says what? Paul said, "I'm an apostle of Jesus Christ, for the gospel, the good news of God concerning his Son, declared to be the Son of God in power according to the Spirit of holiness by his resurrection from the dead, Jesus Christ, our Lord." And then Paul said this, "Even if we or an angel from heaven should preach to you a gospel contrary to the one that we preach to you, let him be accursed." And that's where this nonsense from Nicholas Notovitch lies. Every so often, this type of thing comes up. There was a bunch of stuff written hundreds of years ago. This is more recent. Joseph Smith did his thing back in the 1800s. There was somebody earlier, about 100 years ago or so, that had similar ideas about India that they imagined, like, faintly puffed up in their mind, etc. We need to be able to help people that get distracted with these things. And we need to be able to answer them and show them the facts. And remember what Paul said. The gospel of God, Jesus declared to be the Son of God by the resurrection from the dead, and reject these nonsense gospels. Thank you for your attention this morning, and if anyone needs to respond not to the Issa of Notovitch, but to Jesus Christ, you can do that as we stand and sing.